All right, welcome to another edition of It's Not Brain Surgery, the AANS Practice and Business Management Podcast. And today, we're really not going to talk about brain surgery. The topic today is final tidbits and tools ABNS update. So we're going to be talking with someone very important from the American Board of Neurological Surgery. Our guest today is Russ Launcer. Russ graduated from Andrews University in 1990 and a medical degree from Loma Linda University in California. He did his neurosurgery training at Utah and performed a two-year research fellowship under the mentorship of the superb legendary tumor surgeon Ed Oldfield at the NIH. And Russ then went on to become chief of the surgical neurology branch at the NIH before becoming professor and chair of the Department of Neurological Surgery at The Ohio State University. In 2012, he holds the Dardinger Family Chair in Neurosurgical Oncology. Russ is the author of over 300 scientific and clinical publications. He's won a number of awards as young tumor investigator from both the AANS and the CNS, and he's served organized neurosurgery in a number of roles, including a long time on the CNS Executive Committee, treasurer, and eventually president of the Congress of Neurological Surgeons. Russ now serves as a director on the American Board of Neurological Surgery, and most recently has probably the most important and most difficult and time-consuming job on the board as secretary. So Russ, welcome to the It's Not Brain Surgery podcast.
Thanks so much, Bob. Super excited to be here, and it's always great to hear and see you.
Well, likewise. Why don't you start by just giving us a little history of your trip through neurosurgery, you know, where you started and how things went at the NIH and where you've ended up now.
Sure. And you gave a very kind introduction, Paul, and it hit a lot of the highlights. But, you know, I did my research time, as you mentioned, with Ed Oldfield at National Institutes of Health during residency. I finished my residency at University of Utah, and then Ed had invited me back. And I was, you know, super excited. I've always had a passion for research and discovery and innovation in those areas. And spent 13 years at the NIH looking at drug delivery, neoplasia syndromes like von Hippel-Lindau disease, neurofibromatosis, and others. And it was really a rewarding time. And most of my work was translational or clinical. And then I had an opportunity to come out to The Ohio State University.
And gotta say The Ohio State University,
right? I'm still hesitant.
you taught me that. You taught me that, man.
I went to The Ohio State University, and I've been here now for nearly 10 years. We have remarkable faculty, remarkable residents, and it's truly been a wonderful experience. And during that period of time, like you, I think we came onto the board at the same time, and the board's been really a remarkable organization to be associated with, and folks. And having the opportunity to work with folks like you has absolutely been wonderful and probably a highlight of, you know, my career.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to other people on the board and they say the same thing. Give us a little glimpse as to what the board does. So for the, you know, the young neurosurgeon out there who is either on a path to certification or has just become certified, sort of what's the structure of the board? How much work does it entail? For you, it's an incredible amount of work. And just walk us through maybe a day in the life or a year in the life of a board member.
We always start every one of our board meetings with the mission. I think the mission really kind of sums up what the board does. And that's, you know, and I'll paraphrase, it's really to encourage the study, improve practice, elevate standards, and advance the science of neurological surgery. And it's really to serve the cause of public health, you know, and along that includes pieces of certification. We have officers such as the chair, vice chair, treasurer, secretary. Our executive director is Fred Meyer. We have outstanding staff with Betsy Keenan, Carrie Bergman, Susan Butterbaugh, Leanne Lipa, James Kester, and Carrie Bollerman. And many of the young neurosurgeons, program directors, certified neurosurgeons will interact with these people at different levels throughout their career. We have an outstanding group of board of directors. These individuals are nominated by national societies. And moving forward, they can be self-nominated if they want to be. The board will also create nominations. And then these people, based on work and meritocracy, are brought onto the board. The board has a number of roles that go with that mission. And you serve probably one of the most important roles as chair of the Credentials Committee. We also have chairs of committees that manage the data surrounding our diplomates and cases. We have other committee chairs that really look at development of new board members, examiners, and things like that. Each of the board members is intimately involved with the certification process. So we have chairs of the primary or written exam. We also have a chair of the oral exam. But the directors all contribute heavily to the certification process. So along with those defined duties, each board member writes at least 10 primary exam questions and provides at least 2 oral board questions each year, along with meetings throughout the year where we're looking at the quality of the exams. We're constantly reevaluating, reassessing to make the exams most relevant to what we do in practice.
So that's a lot of work, and it involves a lot of time on your part. Talk to us about, you know, the time away from your practice, for instance, and from leading your department that you have to spend to devote to this mission.
Yeah, so I think each of the board members, starting with yourself, Paul, we've all been involved with different organized neurosurgery groups over a number of years. And at some level, as you migrate through that process, the time that occurs now is replacing time that was spent in other national organizations. But I think, you know, from just a pure travel perspective to the winter meetings, the fall meetings, the exams, I mean, you're looking about a month of year of out of office time working with the board. There's other requirements. Each of the chairs of each of those sections of the board does tremendous work in each of those areas. So each of the board members takes on a huge responsibility of time and commitment. I mean, you know that as chair of the credentials committee, you spend tens of hours each month outside of your normal practice and board work managing that super important role. And so I think, you know, outside of that, we have an executive committee that meets each Monday for about an hour. We have other commitments, you know, as we get ready for the oral exam twice a year. The board of directors have an hourly call each week as they prepare the examiners for the exam that many of the officers and many of the board members attend each of those. So it's really a commitment throughout the year. It comes and goes, but it's a, you know, at least a month of travel. But saying all that, Paul, I don't think there's ever been a director that's ever, you know, complained about the time invested. I think all of us feel the incredible value that it provides. And I think we feel like we're all paying back the specialty in these roles. It feels effortless, you know, to
sure
at least
paying back what we've been given, you know.
Yes.
And, you know, you think about the time when you took your boards, things have changed since then, you know.
Yeah.
The days of, you know, being in the hotel in a room and you never knew what cases you're going to get, you know, through the years. Things have kind of been standardized quite a bit. So what can a young applicant expect, let's say, for both the written boards that they take during their residency and then the oral boards?
Yeah, that's a great question, Paul. So let's start with the written boards of the primary exam. It's very different from when you and I took it. Primary exam is now considered a mastery exam. It's a very secure exam. It's been secure for a number of years. It's constantly evolving. Last year, 275 new questions were vetted. These questions are in the exam, when I mean mastery, it's been vetted to become not just a mastery, but a relevant exam. Each exam is now designed, the primary exam, for clinical relevance. It's of the highest quality. I mentioned the 275 questions that were vetted. Only 97 were accepted for potential inclusion in the exam. The exam is continuously reassessed. There's rigorous quality control before and after. You've heard about the quality control before. We vet the questions. All the directors are involved with that. It's a multi-day event. Every single question is reviewed. Questions are rejected because they're factoids, or they're not clinically relevant, or they're poorly written. And even after the exam occurs, the directors re-review the test and see if there are questions that may not have been as entirely relevant or as fair as they could have been. That results in anywhere between 5 and 15 questions being removed. The other important part of the primary exam that has occurred in the last couple of years is all the question stems have been released to the program directors and residents. So now program directors and residents know the entirety of the content that will be on the exam. It goes to, you know, really being the mastery exam. It's kind of like the airline industry where you want pilots to master the critically important things to fly safely. The same thing's now occurring. And I really do believe that's a difference. And I think you would agree with that as well.
Yeah, no, I remember the analogy. It's like, do we want Do you want our pilot to know 75% of how to fly 747? No.
Yes. And we don't want to examine them on the esoteria that is irrelevant to fly. So
exactly. Those changes have been really phenomenal, and that's happened over the last, really, since I've been on the boards in the last 3 or 4 years. And then once they get their writtens passed, and presuming now, of course, the applicant has to pass writtens in order to finish a training program to be certified. And then what do they do before they take their orals or on their way to orals?
Yeah, so I would also mention they have to pass it now moving forward. They have to pass the exam before they begin their chief year. That's a newer requirement. And so then what happens, to your point, what's the next steps in the pathway to certification? So what's new now is 6 months prior to your terminal training. So if you do a fellowship, that's 6 months prior to you finish fellowship training, or 6 months prior to when you finish your residency training, if you don't go on to fellowship, you register with the board so they know you exist and that you're streaming into a pathway towards certification. Once you finish training, within the first 6 months, you have to enter 10 consecutive cases into what we call POST. And POST stands for Practice and Outcomes of Surgical Therapies, where you enter data on cases. You enter, just demographic data about yourself as well. Those cases are reviewed by a director, and they want to make sure that you're tracking through, that you're entering them properly, that you're not missing things, and that your outcomes are starting off on a good path. And that will, once that's approved by the director, you'll enter a total of 125 consecutive cases minimum that will be reviewed before you apply for the board. So you enter your 125 cases. Once that's done, you apply for the boards. A director review your 125 cases. And oftentimes they'll have questions about, do you have additional imaging? Can you provide some more information about this or that? And then once those are approved, you're set up for an exam date. We don't have a backlog. I mean, I think, Paul, when you and I took it, sometimes we could wait a year, 18 months. No longer is there a backlog. Most, if not all, candidates have the opportunity to take the exam within 6 months of submitting all their materials and review of their post materials. So once you get into that, get approved for your oral exam, the oral exam format, before we get to the format, since May 6, 2020, when COVID was in its height, the exam moved from the in-person oral exam that you and I took, where we got a hotel in Houston, St. Louis, right, wherever. And now it's virtual. And it's remained virtual and will remain virtual indefinitely. The response to that by the examinees has been overwhelmingly positive. What happens is you take it from your home on a Friday and or a Saturday. The directors come on site to administer the exam. And so that wherever that site may be, it may be typically in Phoenix, Arizona or Scottsdale. And prior to that, new examiners are entered into a development program where they're, if they're new, they examine with a senior examiner, and they also are taught the parameters and things like that around it, so that the exam can be administered very fairly and uniformly. In the exam, there's three sessions. They don't have to come in this order, but I'll just list the three out. The first is a general neurosurgery session. What would you be expected to do if you were in an emergency room and seeing the common types of trauma? There's five cases for that. Each of these sessions have five cases in it. The second session is the focus practice. So if you have training or a practice that's focused on spine, tumor, vascular, functional trauma, critical care, pediatrics, you have cases defined to that. Now, some people don't have that focus practice and they'll have a general practice. And what we'll do is another session then of general neurosurgery, similar to the first, but a little bit higher level, because the individuals in that practice will typically have a higher level of a broader practice. And then the third potential third session is five cases from your post cases that practice outcomes of surgical therapies will be chosen by the person that reviewed your cases. Five cases will be given to you and you'll know them in advance. And basically you'll walk the examiner through, you'll tell a story about those cases, and the examiners, in a kind of conversational way, we'll ask you questions and things like that. And at the end, there's normatization of the different examiners, because not every examiner is as easy or as hard as the other. So the exam is really made to be clinically relevant and fair at the end of the day. Everybody has standardized questions except for their own case question, series.
Yeah. So when you and I took it, it was three neurosurgeons, spine, cranial, and then the third hour was, wild card. If you had done well, you got really... incredibly difficult cases. The third hour, if you didn't do well on cranial or spine, those would be sort of rehashed. But it was really every neurosurgeon brought his or her own cases. And so the standardization just wasn't there. And so the board has went to great lengths to make the exam fairer. And even to the point of, like you say, normalizing scores after the fact. Used to be that I remember I took my boards, I think it was in New Orleans, or I got a call that night from one of the examiners who knew me and who saw the scores and said, hey, you did okay or something. And now, you know, can't do that because you may not once the examiner's scores are changed.
Yeah. And you bring up a great point. These scores are put in anonymously, you know, so you don't know who examined who, meaning through the three different sets. There's statistical analysis done often in the favor of the candidate. The pass rates have remained remarkably consistent over the past several years with this. And we're looking at anywhere between 10 and 15% non-pass rate, which is similar or a little bit better than, you know, years past. But it's really a fair exam.
Yeah. And you know, the recent thing about adding, you know, a candidate's own cases in to review those was done for a variety of reasons. Talk to us about that. And really, the ABNS is at the forefront compared to maybe the other ABMS boards in terms of gathering this data and then getting a snapshot of what we're doing across the country.
That's, you know, great question. And neurosurgery as specialty leads the way in this across the other specialties. In fact, the folks from the ACGME and ABMS have, you know, acknowledged, have brought this up at, you know, meetings and things like that. Really what we do with that post, what we're really trying to see, that goes again back to that mission statement, it's a service to public health. And what we're trying to really understand is how are candidates practicing, not really the funded knowledge, but what does their practice look like through the oral boards, what's the clinically relevant pieces. That data that we collect will help drive understanding our demographics better, where our specialty is going, what's the real true types of complication rates and things like that that we're seeing across different areas. But when you drill it down to the individual level with those five cases, we're really looking to see everybody has complications. Was there something in retrospect that could be done? But from the candidate, they felt they could have done differently. Was it an indication thing? But just talking about it and saying, hey, maybe I wouldn't do this anymore. I would do it a different way. It also, it's not just complications. This is my typical case. Tell us about what you typically do. Or, wow, when the examiner looked at this, is a really complex case. You know, tell me about your thinking process through this, because this is an interesting thing. So this is really to really understand, you know, the thinking process, the candidate's practice, and to get a better understanding of that at the end of the day.
Yeah. So, you know, when you talked about the mission of the board being public safety and credentialing, and, you know, a lot of the changes that have been made recently have been to try and close some of the, you know, the loopholes, like between the graduation of a resident from a program and the, you know, 2 or 3 year time period it takes them to become certified. You know, the board now will be tracking cases during that period. And then let's just say somebody wants to game the system and really have a very, very conservative practice during post, and then they go hog wild and liberalize their indications maybe after that. Well, the board's going to be looking at that as well, right, with our continuous certification.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so many of these new changes we brought up, as you know, Paul, were done to avoid the front end potential problems from a safety at the front end, but also at the back end, there's continuing certification. Rick Boop leads that effort right now. Cargill Allen and others will do that moving forward. And really what that's about is professionalism, meaning that you're acting in a professional way. So we get letters from your chief of staff or your chair or others like that. We want to make sure you're involved in some type of quality improvement, so morbidity and mortality, that your cases are being presented at that. We want to make sure that you're actually keeping up with the literature. So there's specific articles that are evidence-based studies within neurosurgery, CME related to all of that. And so it's really looking at all the different facets moving later on in career. The board has been very careful about not doing away with the high stakes exams, meaning, you know, you come every 5 years or 10 years to an exam where it may not be relevant to your practice after you're done. That's been done away with a number of years ago. And I think the board has really been a leader in the medical specialty space in really how to manage physicians throughout their career in the most effective way and safest way for public health.
Well, Russ, you've given us a really good overview of the process, what the board does before and after certification. If you had a young person come up to you who's just about ready to sit for their boards, what advice would you give them?
You know, I would tell them, it's just like you were saying, it's not like 20, 30 years ago. The board has evolved. The exam is fair. As much as they can relax, I mean, we all understand that, you know, there's some stress related to this, that the fact that they got to their boards and are sitting for the boards means it's gone through their cases and their experience has been vetted. It's been approved, and that they can expect a fair exam that really reflects the quality of their practice.
Fantastic. Well, it's been an honor having you. I've got one last question for you, Russ, and that is Browns, Bengals, or Buckeyes?
Come on, Buckeyes. For the Ohio State.
Of course. Well, I should have known. Oh, fantastic. Well, thanks, Russ. Dr. Russ Lonser, our guest today, and It's Not Brain Surgery. It's been an honor talking to you, Russ.
An honor to be here. Thanks, Paul.
You bet. I'm Paul Camerata, and this is the close of another episode of It's Not Brain Surgery, the AANS Practice and Business Management Podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and don't forget to look us up soon wherever you get your podcasts.